successful in that, we'll set him to task with lawyers and politicians.
Thanks.
Uh-oh. I hope you can all hear me without the mic. Can you? Okay. I'm going to not use it then. Is that a no?
Maybe.
Okay. I'll try to project. All right. I'll try to yell. Let me start with a couple sort of meta comments. This talk came about as I was thinking about language revitalization work, especially as it tends to go hand in hand with language documentation. And as a grad student, you're certainly taught to do language documentation and do analysis, but you're not taught how to turn that stuff around and make it part of language maintenance efforts. So I've been thinking about this a lot off and on, and this is sort of my first go at trying to sort through some of the ideas and think about a framework for how we conceptualize how revitalization and maintenance efforts fit in with other linguistic goals. Most of my linguistic experience has been working with Indian tribes in the Pacific Northwest. I've also done some work in Mexico, although not strictly documentary. And I'm not a community member. I'm an outside linguist. So that's the perspective that I'm bringing to this. And because of that, I'm hoping to run this talk a little bit non-traditionally today. And I'm going to ask you all for lots of input, especially community members, but everyone as well, as I am thinking about these things. So if you have questions, please feel free to interrupt. Don't feel that you have to wait till the end. And I will at various points pose questions to you, the audience, and see how we as a room feel about this. And in a perfect world, I will then change this presentation to include all the people's comments and then post that PDF so that hopefully we'll have everyone's feedback for that instead of just my own. So let's start by thinking about language maintenance and revitalization as a component of field work, as it's been thought of in the literature, especially recently, in a way that's emphasized the importance of collaborative efforts when working in language communities. Yamada, 2007, in Language Documentation and Conservation, provides a sort of overview of collaborative models and focuses specifically on one. And I think that certainly everyone in this room, I would hope, but I think the field of linguistics more generally has come to see these maintenance efforts as something that's now a valid field of linguistics, that it really is something that it's okay for linguists to spend their time on. Hopefully getting better about that as time goes along. And although there's been lots of talk about collaboration and what collaboration means, there's much less discussion of how we actually implement collaboration when, as linguists, we're working in communities or as community members attempting to set up relationships with linguists. Now, for most linguistic endeavors that we embark on, there's a lot of guidance in how to do things. And there's obviously less so in this situation, in part, I think, because language endangerment represents such a diversity of communities, a diversity of linguists, that the situations are all very different from one another. So maybe before I start, what do we think about the idea of trying to establish some sort of framework for linguists interacting with communities in language maintenance efforts? It's not a rhetorical question. So, like, what framework do you have in mind?
Well, so cross-collaborative frameworks, mm-hmm. cross-cultural collaborative frameworks mm-hmm. come to mind, especially if a linguist maybe of one culture and the target of the language that they're trying to document or capture is another culture. Room.
Yeah.
Which talks a lot about Ansara and its
importance. Yeah, absolutely. My thoughts here are to make something that is more specifically linguistic. So incorporating ideas from that, but how do... So if we're sitting down to write a grammar, we're all sort of familiar with the procedure. We collect texts, we do some elicitation around those texts, all of that. It's the sort of nuts and bolts that I feel like are missing with maintenance efforts, if that makes sense.
Yeah, maybe, but it's the structural part. And didn't the guy this morning talk about law and primary, so calibration of having at the law and primary level possibly first, and then when you go into the third layer of that, that's moving into not necessarily language documentation as much anymore.
Right.
At least that could have been the definition given this morning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anyone else have thoughts about that?
I'd say certainly in Australia, Chris, and in New South Wales, as one state where I come from, there are guidelines for people making any kind of negotiating relationship with Indigenous communities, and they would be documents that I would think would be adaptable. I certainly would see considerable benefit in at least, if maybe not a structured framework, some guidelines about, you know, you should make sure you do some checkboxes, you should do these things, and you definitely shouldn't do these things.
Right.
That would be a good idea.
Yeah. Well, I guess I'm giving this talk, right? So I think it's important and a worthwhile thing to spend energy thinking about. And I think that this should become part of training linguists to go do field work. So even if it is just sort of checkboxes to give people an idea when they show up in a community or start making contact with a community, what sort of things should they be doing and shouldn't they be doing is important, I think. So let me talk a little bit about the problem that I see from my outside non-community member perspective. So in terms of linguistic fieldwork, most people in linguistics ought to, at this point, consider this to be true linguistic science, that it really is getting at something that's replicable, that the facts of language that are presented in reference grammars are motivated and are present in the language. And since we're at such a time of language endangerment, this is certainly important that we're, as linguists, producing documents which are hopefully accurately representing the aspects of language that they talk about. The problem with most of these documents and products and things is that this doesn't really get back to the community. And even if it does get back to the community, you often hear stories of people who write a grammar of a language and send the village a copy, which is essentially inaccessible to anyone without linguistic training, not to mention that if you do your fieldwork in Mexico and you write your dissertation in English, not only is it technical, but it's in a language that most of the people in that community don't speak. And I think this becomes dangerous in that it tends to make claims of language endangerment self-fulfilling. Linguists want to go work on a language that's very endangered. They spend lots of time there working with speakers. But they're actually, I think, ending up often making it more endangered, in part because, especially in very endangered communities, the time that a linguist spends working with the master speakers of that language is time that that person could have been playing with their grandkids and teaching them the language. So if a linguist is going to go to a community and use time of the speakers of a language, then the outcome of that work ought to be something that feeds back into the community. Maybe I'll put both these questions up here. So how do linguists do documentary work in such a way that it doesn't contribute to language death? And how do they engage with revitalization efforts while still doing the linguistic stuff that gets us tenure and things like that. You guys have thoughts about this? Yes.
I think it depends largely on the community, how the community wants to make use of the material, and I'm kind of assuming some kind of tribal or community structure. I'm not sure the linguist can do a whole lot. It's up to the community.
I agree with you. I think it's entirely up to the community, except in as far as in producing materials, is there a way to produce them so that they're accessible to folks without a PhD in linguistics? And that, I think, is the issue that I'm trying to get at with this framework. As you can see, I'm waffling around. Yeah.
The point is, you just need to ask the community what they want. And as was brought up by some speakers this morning, that linguists aren't on their own. That to be successful in revitalization or maintenance, that it needs a team of people. And that team, of course, includes community members and community language workers.
Absolutely.
And the community, quite readily, will tell you what they want. You know, for example, we were producing books with audio, accompanying audio recordings. And one of the old men said, "My girl, can't you put this on a DVD?" Sure we can.
Mm-hmm.
And there, so, you know, but if you ask the community, they will tell you what kind of resources they want, but it can't be a linguist working in isolation. It must be a team.
Absolutely. And I'm going to come back to that a little bit at the end, actually, and talk about the materials that go back to the community.
The dilemma of using or recording people that could otherwise be playing with their grandchildren, could you record them while they are playing with their grandchildren?
Absolutely, that would be awesome. I don't think very many people do that, though, because then it's noisy and it's hard to hear and you get sort of basic language. So yeah, that would be awesome. But that's not something that, I don't know the last time I saw a reference grammar that had.
Yeah, but this morning in a session in another room, Rob Emery was talking about the case study of trying to do revitalization from a language that was recorded by missionaries in the last
mm-hmm.
two centuries ago in the 1830s. And the fact that, you know, that not much was recorded of ordinary conversation, and you know, the conversation used in ordinary mundane life, of going fishing and you know, bathing the kids or something like that. And he was advocating that you know that kind of recording should be fundamental documentation for linguistic research.
Yeah, I agree entirely. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, which I think gets at the importance of collaborative and long-term relationships, that even if I'm writing this grammar right now, right, I'm going to continue working with you after that's done. Preparing these slides kind of drove me crazy because this is such a big topic that I'm not sure you could sketch the framework in the way I'm thinking about it in an entire book, much less a 20-minute talk. So I'm going to focus on two main areas here. The first being goal setting, which we've talked about in terms of asking the community what they want, and also how to then provide access to those materials, which is certainly related if one of the community goals is access. So the first thing we need to do in a collaborative project is set goals as part of this language team. And we may have goals of our own, but certainly talking to this team of community members is an important part of establishing outcomes for a project. But how do we set collaborative goals? Not sure I know the answer to this. I mean, it involves this sort of talking to the community, spending a lot of time thinking about things. And so I can see sort of two ways to do this. One is to have essentially separate sets of goals with the agreement that the whole team sort of does both in a give and take relationship. So I need this kind of data, but I'm also happy to collect stories, conversation, whatever it is that you'd like as well. And the other way then would be to come up with a set of shared goals, which can contribute both to whatever the linguist is intending as well as the community's goals. Do you have thoughts about that? So I worked, I think most of these are probably a mix of these two. I don't know that it's an either or situation. So I did a project producing a language textbook with, audio clips of the various, it was a book of a word list essentially, and producing a CD to go along with that with the pronunciation of the words and then the translation. And I was interested in phonetic analysis, but I didn't necessarily need specific words. I could use any words. So I recorded those words to use for the analysis, and then also provided them on a CD to produce as part of the book. So there's still a part there then where it's separate, where I'm doing that extra thing. But in terms of the sort of first bits, it was the same. Yeah.
In that example, because your goal is in fact different, divergent, but it's the activity that's satisfying divergent goals.
Right. And I could envision sort of like, sorry, I don't know your name.
Matt.
That if you're trying to do linguistic analysis, you can use a whole range of genres and texts to do that. So, yeah, at the end there might be sort of two parts, but this idea of recording stories and making them available to the community. Yeah, so I don't know that it's ever possible to have exactly the same goals, unless you're a tribal linguist, in which case your goals might be essentially the same, or hopefully would be. Sure, sure. I'm going to skip this stuff. How about? So great, we have goals. Yay. Hopefully we're all happy with our goals, the community and the team and the linguist or linguists. And so we collect all this data, but then how do we go about making sure that it actually does return to the community? How do we provide, as linguists, the access to the materials that the community wants? And actually, I'd even argue in some cases that they might not want at this point, but that someone in 50 years might want. People have thoughts about this? Oh? Yeah, well.
You self-publish first, so it's affordable to the community.
Mm-hmm. But in terms of preparing the materials, so if it's still a reference grammar, I guess I think of accessibility more in terms of actually presenting the knowledge and not necessarily... So if you're, for a reference grammar, for example, even if you self-publish it, to most of the community...
The community wouldn't want a reference grammar.
Right. So if you've written a reference grammar, what comes out of that project that the community would be able to make use of?
A non-technical
grammar. Okay. Right. So a non-technical, a pedagogical grammar, or a learner's grammar, or something like that.
You're going to guarantee that you give a range of outcomes in a range of formats, in a range of media that people want to access. So if you're just talking about grammars, it's going to stay the same story, more or less. So it needs to be negotiated right up front what the community want, and that, you know, that work is then part of that outcome. It would be a great variation.
Yeah.
And going on from what Himmelman was talking in the plenary, at that initial primary data stage and raw data stage, the primary data can be made more accessible if, let's say, you have transcriptions and video. One thing I found is to release that primary data in accessible form, like DVDs, subtitled DVDs of your primary data. So, you know, DVDs of narratives and stuff with a straight transcription and a free translation without your morphological analysis.
Yeah.
Releasing that to the community, that's what I've done.
Yeah, and things like Shoebox, putting it through something like Elan or Lexi Pro, where you can take out those lines, you can select specifically what you want, then is a way, I think, to meet sort of these two different goals from the same source of data. Yeah.
We're kind of like fish out of water because we're applied linguists and L2 teacher training and L2 materialist design.
Mm-hmm.
But we collaborated with a field linguist who was doing work with Mocho in Mexico, and she didn't know how to create more materials that might be useful for teaching the language, and so she consulted with us and two other colleagues. And so maybe a third piece of the collaboration, you have the community field linguists and then some applied linguists who can work with you to create materials that would be useful in schools, to create storybooks that rely on theories of second language acquisition to reinforce the language.
Yeah, I'm really glad you brought up that point, actually. So most of the work that I've done in communities is actually working with people in the language program who want to teach the language. So the DVD isn't quite enough because they don't know exactly how their language works and how they should go about teaching it. They might not even be speakers. So the DVD is certainly valuable, but it doesn't have what they need to then sit down and design lessons. But nor does a pedagogical, or a reference grammar, because it's not accessible to them. I think either as a linguist you need some of that training or need to collaborate with someone else who has that training.
And we're all housed together in linguistics department, so we
might as well be better. Yeah, there you go. So we talked about all that stuff. So let me start winding down. And so I want to return to this idea of giving back to the community sort of what they want. And also I'd say I think that we need to be thinking about it beyond the bounds of what any one community might want for a given situation. And we see this especially when we look at old materials produced say more than 50 years ago, although even up through the 70s probably, where the materials are often confusing to linguists in orthography, especially working in the Pacific Northwest. Every linguist seems to have had their own transcription system. Texts tend not to be parsed in gloss. They tend to have a sort of literal but also free word-by-word translation. So how do we incorporate those materials into this collaborative framework? And how do we use that then to inform what we're providing back to the community with this hindsight of, okay, someone did this 50 years ago and thought that this was the way to do it, but now it's sort of less useful than it might be. So how do we think forward in terms of thinking about and designing and planning the work that we're doing. So one is to ignore old materials, or one option for this is to ignore old materials. I think very few of us at this conference probably have that luxury, given that I imagine most of us are working with endangered languages. The other way, of course, is to incorporate those materials somehow into the project. Especially in extremely endangered language situations where the written materials were often collected when there was a much larger community of speakers from a linguist who may well have spent a lot more time working with speakers and worked with more speakers than are currently living. I actually want to go back just for the last couple minutes to not talk so much about actually including these goals, but this idea of what we provide back to communities in terms of what the community asks for. And so I think things like being able to output text in different ways, but still having the database that has, for example, the morphological analysis there. So in a situation like that, even if the community doesn't want it, making sure they have a copy of not just the literal and free translation, but also of the database in case someone from the community does end up getting a PhD in linguistics and wants that information. Do you guys have thoughts about that? Has anyone worked with languages that have lots of old stuff? Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Sorry. There we go. Thanks.
Thank you, Chris. I'm sure Chris will be available outside to take up discussions and answer questions for anyone who's still interested.
Sure.
For the rest of you, I'd ask that you quickly make your way to your next venue, unless you're staying here for the pick of the presentations this afternoon.
Do we know who is
next?
I'm wondering how I should disconnect myself.